anyone who knows me as a speaker, and my former NEA colleague Felicia Knight, you know, can testify, is I am infamous for always speaking without notes, because I like to speak to people directly. But tonight I've done something rather unusual. I've actually written out part of what I want to say, so you'll see why I usually speak without notes. And I thought I would do is I wanted to actually go right to the topic that this whole series is, which is about the parables. And I want to begin with a famous parable and then talk about it and talk about what it tells us about why we need literature and why we need art. And then about halfway through the lecture, I'll leave my notes behind. I'll elaborate a little bit of this if I have time to talk about what I think is this one of the central issues that we face in our culture. And every artist, and I'm so glad that so many of the artists in the audience introduced themselves to me as they came in, which is the notion of recovering beauty, of understanding what beauty is, what its relationship to truth. Then I'm finally going to read you a couple of poems, and then I'll take some questions, if anyone's still in the hall. You know, we'll have to see when I'm done whether you think the Lord has blessed you or not, or whether, you know, we're all suffering for our sins. Let me tell you a story, okay? A certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me." And he divided unto them his living. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country, and there wasted his substance in riotous living. And when he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in the land, and he began to be in want. And he went and he joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would fain have filled his belly with the husks that the swine did eat, and no man gave unto him. And he came to himself and said, "How many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants." And he arose and came to his father. But when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion. And he ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said unto him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and am no more worthy to be called thy son." But the father said to his servant, "Bring forth the best robe, and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand, and shoes on his feet, and bring hither the fatted calf, and kill it, and let us eat and be merry." Now his elder son was in the field, and he came and drew nigh to the house, and he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said unto him, "Thy brother is come, and thy father hath killed the fatted calf, because he hath received him safe and sound." And he was angry, and would not go in. And therefore came his father out, and entreated him. And he answering said to his father, "Lo, these many years do I serve thee, neither transgressed I at any time thy commandment, and yet thou never gavest me a kid, that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this thy son was come, which hath devoured his living with harlots, thou hast killed for him the fatted calf." And he said unto him, "Son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. It was meet that we should marry and be glad, for this thy brother was dead and is alive again, and was lost and is found." That is the story. Now, as we are accustomed to ask, what does it mean? What it means is, a certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, and so forth to the end. The story is its own meaning, and it speaks to us in its own way, with no necessity of abstraction or commentary. My lecture this evening will explain several ideas, but it will begin and end with a single point, namely, that if you want to understand this story, you can only do so as a story. Of course, one can create an interpretation or offer a commentary. One can draw a moral or one can abstract a principle. But each of these activities is both less than and different from the actual story. Let us take this universally known parable of the prodigal son, which is used frequently in homiletic literature, in Sunday sermons, to preach forgiveness or compassion. And truly, we see the father as an exemplary figure of compassion and of forgiveness. When his son returns in filth and poverty from wasting the family's legacy in sin and in dissipation, the father does not wait for the apology or the explanation. He runs out to greet his son with kisses and with joy before the son has said a single word. The son has seen the error of his ways, and the father lovingly forgives him, and they both rejoice in their reunion. This is a wonderful and uplifting explanation that we have all heard before, right? We've heard it in classrooms, and we've heard it in church. But I hope you'll understand how much it simplifies and actually distorts what the real story is. It sentimentalizes it, and therefore betrays the meaning of Jesus' actual parable. You don't have to go very far into the parable to demonstrate how distorted this conventional exploration. You simply have to read the first six words of the parable. A certain man had two sons. The way that we think of this, when we abstract it, when we sentimentalize it into a father forgiving a wayward son, we diminish and lessen what is being said. To characterize the parable as a single line between a father and a son misses the full meaning of the parable, which is simultaneously between a father and his younger son, a father and his older son, an older and a younger brother, and all of them together. And I'm forgetting, you know, his employment in the far land, but in terms of just those characters, not to mention the various and differing relations between servants and masters, friends and family throughout the tale. The story does not consist of a single and direct line between any two people, or even between any three people. Even this short and deliberately universalized tale that runs only 400 words in the King James Bible is a complex and dynamic constellation of multiple meanings. Now, I've picked this great parable from Luke to make the point because I don't think anyone here will claim that Jesus was an ineffective public speaker, that Jesus did not know how to tell a story or draw a moral, that he was unable to get the point that he wanted to make to the audience across clearly. An audience which includes Christians realizes that Jesus is not only talking to his immediate audience in Roman-occupied Israel, he's also speaking through the ages universally to mankind. And I would mention that even an atheist hearing this story would have to admire Jesus' literary skill and moral intelligence to create such a rich and complex tale in only 400 words. And this has been a story that has fascinated artists in particular, I guess, you know, one in a few weeks even. I mean, including Rembrandt, Rainer Maria Rilke, Sergei Prokofiev, and George Balanchine, all of whom have done masterpieces based on this. Any Christian, especially any Christian theologian, must ponder the fact that when Jesus spoke to the multitudes, he spoke in parables. In fact, his board of directors, the apostles, frequently complained about this because they felt that, you know, you needed to get it down into sound bites. Just as the God of the Old Testament often chose to speak in narratives and, forgive me, lyric poetry. Now, isn't it odd to a commonsensical person that God chose an artistic medium rather than a straightforward parable or straightforward explanation in abstract conceptual language, just as philosophers or theologians or social scientists do? Wouldn't it be clearer? Wouldn't it be more accessible, more accurate, more useful simply to give us abstract principles such as, thou shalt not waste thy inheritance on harlots, or thou shalt forgive thy children, at least thy younger son, his trespasses? In other words, I believe that in probably 90% of Christians, there's this deep suspicion that maybe God doesn't know how to do things properly. Why didn't Jesus speak in a more orderly and organized fashion? Now, these mild blasphemies may seem far-fetched, but I suggest that they point out to a huge, crippling problem in contemporary American Christianity. Our churches, our theologians, our priests, our ministers have mostly lost touch with the essential and necessary interdependence between religion and art, between truth and beauty, and perhaps even by extension, between flesh and spirit. We have lost, therefore, an important aspect, a central fact of Christ's birth, life, and death, which is to say, the nature of incarnation. Each of these complex dialectics, truth and beauty, religion and art, flesh and spirit, incarnation and divinity, temporal and eternal, is an enormous and ultimately unknowable topic. I will not pretend to explore them tonight, but I need to mention them to frame the specific topic of narrative as a means of theological knowledge, as a means to spiritual truth in its proper perspective. The relationship between truth and storytelling is not a minor matter for Christians. It does not merely touch on some abstract aspect of our theology. It goes to the very essence of how we know ourselves, how we know the world, how we know our Creator. Now, having talked around the topic, let me make three large observations about storytelling, about narrative as a form of knowledge, or to frame the argument more broadly, about poetry or poesis, by which I mean all types of imaginative literature as a way of knowing the world. First, art is a legitimate, separate, and discrete way of knowing the world and expressing the world, different from, but not inferior to, other kinds of knowledge, scientific knowledge or conceptual knowledge. This principle applies especially to literature, which we're talking about tonight, about saying truth in words. Because poetry, narrative, and drama convey essential truths of human existence in complex but accessible ways, which is, how do you tell people a complex truth in a way which they can grasp, they can experience, they can internalize, they can remember? Now, how does poetic knowledge differ from other kinds of knowledge, like scientific, philosophical, or conceptual knowledge? Isn't poetic knowledge, and by extension all narrative, really a kind of inferior sort of knowledge? Isn't it kind of soft and squishy, you know, compared to what we would find in a book of philosophy or a book of ethics? Isn't it just a thin fabric of truth, lavishly embroidered by decorative elements? You know, or what one of my great guides, the French philosopher Jacques Maritain. Has anybody here read Maritain? Oh, it's one of the great aesthetic theologians. He says, isn't poetry just science for the feeble-minded? These common notions of art and poetry as an inferior, secondary kind of knowledge, a way of sort of sugarcoating an abstraction, are among the great, lazy, unexamined assumptions of contemporary thought, especially among Christians. Art is a distinct and irreplaceable way of knowing the world and expressing the world, because it alone, unlike science or philosophy, uses and engages the fullness of our humanity. What Jesus knew when he preached his parables was that through storytelling, through poetry, you can engage us simultaneously intellectually, emotionally, physically, our memory, our intuition, our imagination, without dividing them, but speak to us in the fullness of our creation. Art, poetry, narrative, and by extension painting, music, dance, theater, recognize, as philosophy seldom does, that we are not pure spirit. We are not some ghost temporarily inhabiting a body, not even bodies and souls coexisting in some uneasy partnership. We are both body and soul, inseparable and whole. What we know through our bodies does not come entirely from some abstract spirit. And when we are promised resurrection, we are promised complete resurrection, the reunion of the completeness of our humanity. Art, poetry, and narrative recognize that holistic and experiential knowledge is primary to humanity, and that there are authentic ways of knowing that cannot be duplicated by conceptual thinking or scientific analysis. Just as there are types of knowing that science can offer, that art cannot duplicate. Each is separate and discreet, powerful and legitimate, a way of knowing the world. Now, this notion leads to my second main observation, that there are some truths we can convey, understand, and preserve only as stories. There are some essential truths about human existence that are so complex and elusive and surprising, even often alarming, that they can only be conveyed, understood, and preserved in narratives. So much of human experience depends on context, on timing, on relationship, on cause and effect, and the only truthful way that we can express this is in a story. The parable of the prodigal son, for instance, simultaneously tells us of the father and the son, brother and brother, master and servant, older and younger child, ambition and despair, patience and disappointment, sin and repentance, forgiveness and love, jealousy and anger, friendship and exploitation, experience and wisdom. It tells us all of this and more without simplification, and yet in a way that is immediate, accessible, moving, and memorable from childhood to old age. This is the power of art, of narrative. There have been countless commentaries written on the parable, but which of us would be willing to say that they exhaust or equal the meaning of the original? And which of them can match the power, the compression, the astonishing veracity of the original, in which almost every verse radiates meaning? Those 400 words in Luke overwhelm millions of words of commentary, not only because of Jesus' mastery as a storyteller, but because Jesus knew that there were some truths that are best conveyed and possibly only conveyed as a story, and that not all truth is simple or static. Conceptual commentary is an inferior medium, and in some cases, to get at the truth of the incarnate and material world, we need to materialize this in a narrative. We tell stories because humanity needs them. Some truths are so dark and terrible that they need the pleasure of artistry to be willingly received and understood. Think of the story of King Lear. The universal temptation is to make truth smaller than it really is, to take the complex, dynamic reality of life and turn it into simple abstractions. And what makes the story work compellingly is ultimately the notion of beauty, which is to say, to take the welter of experience and find in it the hidden form whose discovery gives us the pleasure to see clearly to the core of meaning. St. Thomas Aquinas, and I'm a Catholic, so I had Aquinas beaten into me at an early age, said that there are three parts of truth, three parts of beauty. The Latin terms are integritas, consonantia, and claritas. Integritas, wholeness, that you see the shape of something in reality. The artist creates a shape, a story, or whatever. Secondly, as you perceive that shape, you see the different parts that make it up, the characters, the situations, the images, the settings, and you begin to see the consonantia, the harmony that the parts have to make the whole. And as you see the macrocosm and the microcosm, and the perfect relationship that it has, this is where he says claritas. Now, claritas is not clarity. It is shining forth. That as you see this, there is the shining forth, the epiphany, in which you see the secrets of being radiating into the intelligence. Now, notice he doesn't use the word mind, but the full human intelligence, the things that we know with our bodies, and things that we know with our senses. And if you think of this, this is what we have lost in our churches, in our worship, and in the ways we speak in the world. I know as a Catholic that Michelangelo, Bramante, Mozart, Dante brought more souls to God than any priest or any minister. if you lose this powerful way of speaking into the world to address us in the fullness of our humanity, you lose one of the main conversations that we can have with people. I'll leave it at there. I could talk forever. and I'll recite a few poems, and then I'll be happy to do some questions. Let me start with a very short poem that has kind of a long explanation. And then I'll probably do just four poems, I think. This one is so short, it's really like not even a poem. About 15 years ago, NPR asked me to write a poem for New Year's Day. And so I wrote an elegant 36-line poem about the idea of New Year's. And it was snazzy, polished stuff. And after it was broadcast, I looked at it and I said, I want to work on this a little bit more before I publish it. So I began to work on it, and it got a little shorter. It went from 36 lines to 32 lines. And then about a week later, it was down to 28. Then I began to revise it to 24, to 20, 18. It was 16 lines, and I said, I think I'll revise it and turn it into a sonnet. But it went to 12 lines. It went to 10 lines. And finally, when it was 8 lines long, I realized the problem. It was verbose. And so I made it 6 lines long, and it no longer had anything at all to do with New Year's. But that's okay, because sometimes you're trying to follow that, that's whatever the secret of the inspiration. And it became a poem that was really about how much of the life we lead is invisible to anyone else. Everybody who came here tonight has brought their whole life here. And every one of you will hear me differently because of that. And even those closest to you only know a fraction of all the things that are inside. And the poem is called Unsaid. So much of what we live goes on inside. The diaries of grief, the tongue-tied aches of unacknowledged love are no less real for having passed unsaid. What we conceal is always more than what we dare confide. Think of the letters that we write our dead. This next poem is just a little poem that takes place at a wedding. And it's in a ballad form. And it's called Summer Storm. We stood on the rented... Actually, it took place here. Because this is exactly about, what people rent a place to do. We stood on the rented patio while the party went on inside. You knew the groom from college. I was a friend of the bride. We hugged the brownstone wall behind us to keep our dress clothes dry and watched the sudden summer storm floodlit against the sky. The rain was like a waterfall of brilliant, beaded light, cool and silent as the stars the storm hid from the night. To my surprise, you took my arm, a gesture you didn't explain, and we spoke in whispers as if we too might imitate the rain. Then suddenly the storm receded as quickly as it came. The doors behind us opened up. The hostess called your name. I watched you merge into the crowd, aloof and yet polite. We didn't speak another word, except to say goodnight. Why does that evening's memory return with this night's storm? A party 20 years ago, its disappointments warm. There are so many might have beens, what ifs that won't stay buried, other cities, other jobs, strangers we might have married. And memory insists on pining for places it never went, as if life might be happier just by being different. Let me end with a poem, and this poem is It's about two things simultaneously. It's about what I've been talking about, which is that there's another thing about stories, is that, and the older I get, the more I know this, we lead our lives by stories. We have a story of our life, and the reason that you need to, or at least one of the reasons you need to study literature, the reason you need narratives, is you need to know how many stories there are in the world, how they have surprising plot turns, and how things can change, so that as the circumstances of your life change, you can you reinvent your stories. You, in a sense, plan for the future. And I've known how people who are unhappy, their stories are unhappy. They can't imagine a way to get where they want to in life. That's the first thing that it's about, the stories by which we lead our lives. The second thing that it's about is about marriage. And marriage is in a sense, the older I get, the more I think marriage is about a conversation, a kind of endless conversation you have with someone, where in a sense you wrap your stories together, and it just propels itself. So you'll have these two themes sort of tumbling through the poem together. I borrow my title from Shakespeare. He said in Midsummer Night's Dream, the lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. Which is to say, all three of them are crazy. And so this poem is called The Lunatic, the Lover, and the Poet. It's a double sonnet, but rather irregular. So you only have 28 lines to go. The Lunatic, the Lover, and the Poet. The tales we tell are either false or true, but neither purpose is the point. We weave the fabric of our own existence out of words, and the right story tells us who we are. Perhaps it is the words that summon us. The tale is often wiser than the teller. There is no naked truth but what we wear. So let me bring this story to our bed. The world, I say, depends upon a tale spoken each night by lovers unaware of their own sorcery. In innocence or agony, the same words must be spoken, or the restless moon will darken in the sky, the night grows still, the winds of dawn expire. And if I'm wrong, it cannot be by much. We know our own existence came from touch, the new soul summoned into life by lust, and love's shy tongue awakens in such fire of flesh on flesh and midnight whispering, as if the only purpose of desire were to explore its infinite unfolding. And so, my love, we are two lunatics, secretaries to the wordless moon, lying awake together or apart, transcribing every touch or aching absence into our endless, intimate palaver, body to body, naked to the night, appareled only in our utterance. Thank you. You know, I'd be happy to answer or try to answer any questions. Sir?
A question that the topic of which to focus, I would say, is the range of story that is good within the context that you're saying. You know, we mentioned beforehand that I'm interested in film. Film, and you know, a lot of people can attack Hollywood, and I don't want to get into that, yeah, that sort of thing. But the thing I want to draw from the touch point of Hollywood is that often there are very rough stories told in very rough ways. There might also be very sentimental stories told in sentimental ways. Yeah. There's a whole lot of things in between. The issue that we sometimes wrestle with as Christians is in going from a softer or sentimental side to a rougher side. Yeah. Do we enter into sin, even entering into the story and entertaining the story, and And so the question is around the range of story and how us becoming who we need to be.
Yeah. No, this is a great question. It's a great question, and it's actually exactly, you know, on tonight's topic. It's really quite interesting when you look at contemporary Christian writing. You'll see a kind of split in some ways between Catholics and at least evangelical Protestants. I think this goes all the way back to the Reformation, all the way back to the Puritanism and Calvinism, is that there is this deep distrust among, especially basically puritanical, Calvinistic Protestants, that somehow if you make, same way that they painted the frescoes over, they took the statues down and things like this, that there's something inherently dangerous about art. Because if you have a story, you can't control every meaning in the story because it radiates out. I mean, stories don't move like this. They radiate. Think of St. Thomas Aquinas, the claritas, the radiating forth of the secrets of being onto our intelligence. And it's the very uncontrollable nature of this. I mean, I think probably, the greatest writer in our language is Shakespeare, a profoundly Christian writer. But, his plays were shut down like everyone else's because they couldn't deal, in a sense, with those elements which were not, they couldn't narrow down and paraphrase. Where Catholic writers, you have full frontal male nudity in the Sistine Chapel. It doesn't bother Catholics, but it becomes this, and it's the notion that you, and I think it's very fundamental, and I don't mean to be divisive. I'm the most ecumenical person you can imagine, but you can't help noticing things in terms of this, that, if you look at Graham Greene, Flannery O'Connor, Evelyn Waugh, these great modern Catholic writers, they're writing about violence, they're writing about drunkenness, adultery, and these things like this, because what they understand is that our situation, we are in a fallen world. If you have simply an uplifting tale of people doing nice things together and getting even better, it's not, it's nice to hear about. But, and what they do is they take people who are in desperate situations in need of grace, and they act out the dramas of redemption. And the dramas of redemption are not always pretty. They are not always linear and straightforward. And so what I would say is the way I judge a narrative is not on this, that, or the other, the little elements. It's about the truth of the overall vision and, in a sense, the ultimate moral responsibility. And you can have a profoundly Christian story ending in sin and damnation. But the fact is that you should know the difference, between right and wrong. Felicia once claimed that I once told her that I'm all for virtue and I'm all for vice, but you got to know the difference, and that's what a narrator has to do. I mean, the really powerful, the greatest narratives we have: Oedipus the King, King Lear. Would be another, to think of a modern thing, Power and the Glory by Graham Greene, are stark, terrifying stories. And the power of them is that you look at King Lear, where father goes against daughter, brother against brother, master against servant, servant against master, sister against sister, husband, wife against husband, Gloucester, the moral center of that play, has his eyes gouged out, by his son and his adulterous lover. And you look at that, and you look at how evil humanity can be, and you see that in that moment of absolute negation, there is the possibility and indeed ultimately the emergence of redemption. And that's the power of it. It says, we will show you the starkest situation you can imagine and then lead you out of it. I mean, what's the greatest poem in Christianity? It's the Commedia of Dante. And where does it begin? It begins in hell. And it's only when you've worked through hell, when you've recognized the possibilities of evil within you, can you, in a sense, understand what it means, what redemption means, what salvation means. Now, that's a very Catholic answer, you know. Miss.
Yeah. You brought up this interdependence of beauty and truth.
Yes.
And it reminded me of my favorite poem from way back in college, Ode to the Grecian Urn.
Yeah.
Well, I have been able to do nothing with that poem all these years, but just love it. All I can do is speak. And I thought maybe you could help me a bit.
But you've answered your own question. The power of art is that it can teach you things that you can't quite paraphrase. That it can reside in you and guide you without, you know, having to write an editorial about why it happens. I mean, and I really do mean that. I mean, how much of what you guys know, how much of what I know, did we learn, you know, through analytical intelligence? We learned it all sorts of experiential ways, and all of that are ways of knowing. And what art does is honor all of the ways of knowing. If we are made in the image of God, all of those ways of knowing are valid. You know, there's not, just because we can't, you know, write it down in three sentences, you know, of abstract principles doesn't mean we don't know it. Any parent knows this. You know, you how much of your knowledge is intuitive, experiential? So, but that Keats's poem is something that each passing year I realize is greater and truer. And I think, sir.
You know, as you say, you're Catholic. I want you to tell me your feeling, but what I'm about to tell you, I was raised Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And when... And I was a rather religious little boy. I wanted to be a priest
mm-hmm.
for a long time.
Yeah.
When I got into high school, I had a Protestant friend that brought me to a real concrete understanding of what I had as a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And then some sort of resentment kind of rose up in me about being engulfed in all these shadow ministries of you know, vestments
yeah.
and liturgy and all that. But I never really got to understand that you must be born again, you must believe in Christ for the remission of sins, that your sin may be forgiven for him. That never really sunk in. Yet. And not that, and I know the sense that other Catholics really do understand that. But that caused in me sort of this resentment that kind of pushed me into this sort of abstract ministry of life, where everything was a lecture and syllabus, and that's what I craved.
Mm-hmm.
And then something happened. One time I was sitting on
the conference. Yeah, but the question, though, is what you're asking.
What is about, because I believe in the ministry of life, but I believe, like you said, we miss the ministry of shadows. We've done it to our parents. And that's why we get such a sparse, wilted response to the gospel. And I believe we really need that
yeah.
shadows. What is the balance?
I, you know, you're asking two. Really, what you're really telling me are two different things. You're telling me about your own personal journey through faith.
Yes.
And seems to me everybody's journey through faith is valid to the degree that they end up in the right relationship, you know, with their life and with God and with their responsibility. And you know, I don't believe, especially right now in this country at this time, that there's any one of these ways that we want to give up. We need every one of these paths open. You know, each of these churches, in the same way that even within a single denomination, different ministers, you know, different forms of worship work for people. You know, they might, what works for one person may not work for another. And these things, we need them all. And the very diversity and vitality of Christianity is one of its strengths. For centuries, we've thought it was our weakness. But I think it's our strength. I mean, one of the things I think that's wonderful about the Catholic Church is our saints, which I know a lot of Protestants don't like. But they say that a soldier can lead a sanctified life. A beggar can find his way to God. A cobbler, a king, even occasionally a poet. And what it says is that there are an infinite number of ways to lead the right life. And that, to me, is a strength. Now, the second thing that you're asking me is more of a theological question, and I don't, purport to, offer, an answer to it, but I think, if it's something that you find, valuable, then let's make the large leap of faith that perhaps it is valuable. And different people need different things. Sir?
With the passing of John Updike, I guess, just the last 48 hours, there was so many like him, elder statesmen of literature going by the wayside. What do you see coming up behind of a new generation of writers? You have the depth and context and syntax and had that American experience, which they grew up without the computer, and now it's
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't, for the most part, think we're living in a great literary age right now. It doesn't even matter if it's commercial, but I mean, just the things that, in terms of this presence of great writers, and I'll be in despair, and then suddenly I'll read a book like Marilynne Robinson's Gilead, and we read her novel Housekeeping. And I'll say, this is a great American novel. It's a unique novel. It's a spiritually alert and profound novel. I'll think, American drama is bankrupt, and then I'll see a play like David Ives' New Jerusalem about the trial of Baruch Spinoza in Amsterdam in the 17th century, and I'll just say, wow. So the fact is, you don't need a lot of great writers around, but it probably helps great writers to have great readers. And and what I've tried to do the last 6 years in the NEA is to help foster a new generation of alert, engaged readers. Because there's a dialectic. I mean, if I don't believe the truth is static, but it's relational and everything else, there's a dialectic between the audience and the author. Updike, managed that. Another great a great writer, I think even greater than Updike, was John Cheever. Another profoundly Christian writer, although it was not well understood, I think, until towards the end of his career. I think the greatest living American poet, he's 87 now, is Richard Wilbur. And if you've ever read any Richard Wilbur, Richard Wilbur is a deeply Christian poet. Once again, I think that wasn't well understood, which is probably why he became famous. And these people are major writers, and so we don't need a lot of them, but we should value the ones we have. But I do think right now there are not a lot of significant Christian writers, and certainly nowhere near what there were 50 years ago in terms of the. Now we have a couple: Tobias Wolff, Ron Hanson. I don't know if you've read it. If people read Ron Hanson's Atticus? Read Ron Hanson's Atticus. Marriott and Ecstasy. I don't want to say anything more about Atticus, but if you go out and read Atticus, which will begin like a murder mystery, and actually in some ways is, you'll know why I'm mentioning it tonight. I think it's a brilliant, brilliant novel. So maybe one or two more questions, and then I should let these poor suffering masses way in the back. Sir.
As a musician and a Protestant, I nevertheless almost fully agree with your view of your Catholic view.
Well, can I say something? Protestants win on music. Especially nowadays.
But we have moved along the way.
Yeah.
And what I love and revere as a in the ethos of the church, of holding up the gospel and being the purveyor of art. And I love that.
Yeah.
And we would not be here in many ways were it not for that thread. Now, at what point, this is a whole semester course.
Yeah.
But at what point was that jettison and art and religious faith for the promulgation of the scripture?
Well, let me give you my theory. Let me give you my theory, because I think it's... I've never seen anybody... But which is that... We're talking about America right now, okay? Which is where we live, and I'm... Personally, I'm happy about that. America has this kind of odd thing. Who were the Catholics that came to the United States? They're people like my family. They were poor. They were not, largely people from metropolitan areas and things like this. And so they created... American Catholicism that basically did not have the artistic traditions that European cousins. Meanwhile, who were most of the Protestants who first came to the United States? They were the iconoclastic Protestants, who were deeply suspicious of things that struck them as too sensuous and things like that. So you had this this odd thing of, since the two types of, in terms of both families of the faith that were, most either distant or suspicious of art. And so we created a Christian culture in the United States, not everywhere, but by and large, that, we're not engaged in these traditions. Then modernism and secularism and these things happened on top of that, where the artists, began pulling away, from church, which is largely a post-war phenomenon. If you go back, even 60 years ago, T.S. Eliot, W.H. Auden, these were, a substantial number of the most important, writers and artists, were still believers. So these things have come together, and by and large, the leaders of the churches have been unconcerned with this. It's somehow, this is a luxury, it's not essential, blah, 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 blah. And they've let it decay, Now, certain things like the music has been maintained, but by and large, it's older music. If the architecture is any good, it's probably older architecture. If the paintings are any good, they're really old, or they were brought over from Europe. And so I think that, what we have to do is we have to reclaim our own legacy, reclaim our own traditions. And that's what I think that the necessary business of the 21st century is. So let me just take one other real quick question and miss.
I'd like to dovetail off that comment. What would you suggest when I do pottery, and I'm with a lot of non-Christian artists, and get attacked pretty readily for my beliefs. How do you recommend dealing in this world?
Well, all you can do is be yourself. I think that the thing you don't want to do is fight with people, be hostile to people. To me, the most persuasive argument we can give is by modeling the best behavior and living a life which is as admirable as we can manage. Saying what we believe, but not trying to, to argue people down or this, that, or the other. And, if we are mocked, to brush it off. I know that sounds odd, but I think that, I would tell you that, we've been asked to forgive our enemies, and we've been asked to love one another, and I think that those are, I've found, oddly enough, even in the rather prickly world of poetry and literature, those are fairly effective methods. I think love is almost always better, than pugnaciousness. I'm going to end with a little piece of Shakespeare, to take about a minute, and then we can go and eat some desserts. This is one of my favorite speeches. It's from As You Like It. By Shakespeare. And if you remember, one of the characters has the odd name of Duke Senior. And his younger brother has usurped his throne. He's gone into exile. He's living in the forests of Arden, which are relatively uncomfortable and primitive places. He's surrounded by his lords, not all of whom are happy to be in the forest. In fact, some of them want to make peace so they can go back and enjoy the pleasures of the court. And this is what Shakespeare says. And the whole poem is actually theological, but it has one overt theological or biblical reference about the penalty of Adam. What he's really saying is that, you know, in the Garden of Eden, it was always late summer. You could pluck the fruit off the trees. The weather was always nice. But that isn't the fallen world. Now, my co-mates and brothers in exile, hath not old custom made this life more sweet than that of painted pomp? Are not these woods more free from peril than the envious court? Here feel we but the penalty of Adam, the season's difference, as when the icy fang and churlish chiding of the winter wind, which when it bites and blows upon my body, even till I shrink with cold, I smile and say, here is no flattery. These are counselors who feelingly persuade me what I am. Sweet are the uses of adversity. And this our life, exempt from public haunt, finds tongues in trees, books in running brooks, sermons in stones, and good in everything. Thank you so much. I think actually this was never on.
Special thank you to Daniel tonight, but also to thank him for the service that he has given America as he has served in this office. The story is really yet to be untold in the sense of all that he was able to accomplish. We had the opportunity tonight to talk earlier about this, and as I mentioned this afternoon, we spoke to an elementary classroom, and it was fascinating to see the response of the teachers as they were listening to this afternoon, because the resonation of truth was so powerful. And it was in this fashion that until recently, the reading rate in America has been plummeting. And looking at the way that impacts America, as we all know in the financial things that are happening to us, how much of the domino effect things are happening. When one person who is trying to build some complex and he can't get the money, and therefore the suppliers who supply him when he builds can't get the work, and the people who then come together to put the supplies together and make the crop, and it just goes on and on and on until you have a domino effect. It's the same thing with the impact on America for not being able to read, and not being able to read well. And I want to mention just a couple things for you, because we may not have opportunities again to have someone like Dan here with us. But his creation of the national initiatives, I want to read this because I want it to go well, with a wider distribution of direct grants to reach previously undeserved communities, making the agency truly national in scope. Through programs such as Shakespeare in American Communities, Operation Homecoming, Writing the Wartime Experience, NEA Jazz Masters, American Masterpieces and Poetry Out Loud, the Arts Endowment has successfully reached millions of Americans across this country. Shakespeare in American Communities, for example, has put more than 65 professional theater companies from 35 states on tour in more than 1,800 communities in all 50 states to perform for nearly 1 million students. And how many students did you say today have go through their life and never see a play?
70% of graduating seniors.
70% of graduating when Tom Brokaw wrote about the Great Generation, what he said was is that those things were never captured in those programs. Many of them went to their graves. Incredible stories that were never told. The resulting anthology was chosen by the Washington Post as one of the top 10 fiction books of 2006, and the documentary film Operation Homecoming became a finalist for the 2007 Academy Award. Poetry Out Loud National Recitation Contest involved more than 150,000 high school students across the country in national poetry recitation contest with awards of $50,000 in scholarships. Reading at Risk and To Read or Not To Read, a question of national consequence, have brought enormous public attention to the importance of reading and arts participation. In addition, the NEA has assumed a major role in shaping the national discussion on issues of art and art education. And finally, the Big Read has become the largest literary program in the history of the federal government. By the end of 2008, 400 communities will have held month-long celebrations of great literature. Because of these successes, as well as the combined artistic excellence of the NEA's core grant program, the Arts Endowment under Chairman Gioia has reestablished itself as the premier federal agency and leader in the arts and art education. Our prayer should be that whoever President Obama appoints for this next position to follow him will continue these efforts, because it truly is changing the fabric of America. And for the first time in this last year, Chairman Gioia, as he was in that position, said that reading rates for the first time begin to go upward in America. And that's very soon.